Advertising your business with GCN is simple, effective,
and more affordable than you might think.
Visit advertise.gcnlive.com for more info. Take your business to the next level.
You can stick it to the man and big tech. Join our FTL social mastodon at social.freetalklive.com.
Welcome to Liberty Conspiracy on Free Talk Live. I'm Gardner Goldsmith, the founder, if one can use that parlance, of the Liberty Conspiracy. And I'm delighted to join you via the great team at Free Talk Live. Tonight, we get together to share key portions of Liberty Conspiracy Live, which can be heard live Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on Rockfin and Rumble. You can watch there, you can chat there, or you can watch on my Twitter/X feed, which is at Gard Goldsmith. And, of course, you can hop in after the fact and see any of the recorded programs on Rumble and Rockfin. And please feel free to visit my Substack, which is Gardner Goldsmith Substack. I know, inventive name. Hey, let's get right to it with Liberty Conspiracy on Free Talk Live. Remember this line.
We have heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And you know, is the price worth it?
I think this is a very hard choice, but we think the price is worth it.
The reason I teed that up from 1996 is because the United States government obviously doesn't have a very good track record. How many innocent people have been killed, even as Americans cheered them on? So I want to turn now to Jacob Hornberger's piece for today. Because that scene that you just saw is part of this. So let's think about what the United States has done as it has interfered with and destroyed millions of lives. He writes, Jacob Hornberger, and there he is, right there, head of the Future Freedom Foundation, founded in the 1989, I think it was. While some American mainstream commentators express concern about the large death toll among children in Gaza, we mustn't forget that when it is the U.S. government, and specifically the U.S. National Security Branch of the government, that is killing large numbers of children, most U.S. mainstream commentators go into silent mode, or even worse, play supportive roles in such killings. Who can forget the 1990s when U.S. officials were killing hundreds of thousands of Iraqi children with nary a concern expressed by U.S. mainstream commentators? And Mr. Hornberger is not talking about the United States literally directly attacking with soldiers and bombs and weapons. He's talking about the earlier form of war, the blockade, that was referred to by Leslie Stahl and answered in the affirmative, it was worth it, by Madeleine I'm Burning Now Albright. Oh, sure, it's true that those killings were being inflicted by economic sanctions rather than bombs, but so what, say some. The Iraqi children were just as dead. The Iraqi children were just as dead. What difference does it make, to quote Hillary, whether a child is killed by sanctions instead of bombs? The official mindset towards the mass numbers of Iraqi children being killed by the U.S. government was perfectly reflected in the infamous response that Madeleine Albright gave in 1996 to Leslie Stahl of 60 Minutes. Stahl pointed out that 500,000 Iraqi children had been killed by U.S. and U.N. sanctions, more than the number killed at Hiroshima as a result of the U.S. government's targeting of the civilian population, including children of that city, with a nuclear bomb. Stahl asked Albright, is the price worth it? Albright replied, we think the price is worth it. End quote. Albright was the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. As such, she was the official spokesperson for the U.S. government to the world. She was serving in the Clinton administration. No one within the government criticized her statement, and there was little, if any, condemnation among U.S. mainstream commentators. That's because her callous statement undoubtedly reflected the mindset of both her cohorts in the U.S. government and the mindset of the government's loyal supporters in the mainstream press. That mindset was a classic example of Hannah Arendt's term, the banality of evil. What was the it to which Albright was referring? Worth it. The it was regime change. A U.S. foreign policy concept that has been at the center of U.S. national security state, of the U.S. national security state, ever since this governmental structure was brought into existence after the Second World War. U.S. officials decided that they wanted to get rid of Iraq's dictator, Saddam Hussein, whom, of course, the United States put in, and replace him with another U.S. stooge. But Saddam refused to budge. Thus, the purpose of the sanctions was threefold. One, to induce Saddam to resign, after which the deadly sanctions would be lifted. Two, induce the Iraqi people to rise up in a violent revolution against Saddam's government, which would produce more massive deaths. Or three, incite a coup in which Iraq's national security establishment assassinated or otherwise removed Saddam from power and replaced him with a U.S.-approved puppet. According to a review at National Catholic Report, at National Catholic Reporter of Joy Gordon's excellent 2012 book, Invisible War, the United States and the Iraq Sanctions, quote, UNICEF documented the deaths of 500,000 children under five from dysentery and malnutrition. Joy Gordon says the latest figure is now up to 880,000. All three U.S. administrations, Bush, Clinton, and W. Bush, whenever challenged on their responsibility for an epidemic or a famine, simply blamed Saddam Hussein. Writes Hornberger, how could they blame Saddam Hussein? They said that all he had to do was stop the killings of the Iraqi children and resign. They said that all he had to do to stop the killings of the Iraqi children was resign. U.S. officials made it clear that once he resigned, they would lift their deadly sanctions, and therefore no more Iraqi children would have to die. Therefore, in their twisted and perverted logic, they said it was Saddam, not U.S. officials, who were imposing and enforcing the sanctions, who was actually responsible for the deaths caused by the sanctions. In other words, he was hiding behind innocent women and children as the United States engaged in a program to try to starve them to death. A 2003 article entitled Sanctioned Genocide stated, quote, the UN humanitarian reports on the blockade's effects on Iraqi children tell a grisly tale. In December 1995, the UN Food and Agriculture Organization reported 576,000 Iraqi children had died as a direct consequence of economic sanctions. In March 1996, a World Health Organization study released that the blockade release found that the blockade had caused a six-fold increase in the mortality rate of Iraqi children under age five. UNICEF reported in October 1996 that 4,500 Iraqi children under five were dying every month as a result of sanctions-induced starvation and disease. Two high UN officials, Dennis Halliday and Hans von Sponeck, resigned their posts because they did not want to be part of what they labeled genocide. In a 2021 interview, Halliday stated, quote, this completely undermined the water treatment and distribution system of Iraq, which depended on electricity to drive it. And it drove people to use contaminated water from the Tigris and the Euphrates. That was the beginning of the death knell for young children because mothers were not breastfeeding. They were feeding their children with child formula, but mixing it with foul water from the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. In addition, these conflicts introduced a new weapon called depleted uranium, which was used by the U.S. forces driving the Iraqi army out of Kuwait. That was used again in southern Iraq in the Basra area and led to massive accumulation of nuclear debris, which led to leukemia in children, which took 3, 4, or 5 years to become evident. When I got to Iraq in 1998, the hospitals in Baghdad and also, of course, in Basra and other cities were full of children suffering from leukemia. Those children, we reckon perhaps 200,000 children, died of leukemia. At the same time, Washington and London withheld some of the medicines and treatment components that leukemia requires. Again, it seemed in a genocidal manner, denying Iraqi children the right to remain alive. Writes Hornberger, it's worth mentioning that prior to the U.S. killing of Iraqi children as a way to get regime change in Iraq, Saddam Hussein had been a partner, an ally of the U.S. national security state during the 1980s. That was when U.S. officials were helping Iraqi forces to kill Iranian citizens in Iraq's war of aggression against that country. And he has articles that he has written all about that. Of course, Iran is pertinent to this discussion because while U.S. officials no longer target the people of Iraq with deadly sanctions, they continue to target people in other nations, including children, with death by sanctions. Iran, along with Venezuela, Cuba, North Korea, Russia, China, and other targets of regime change come to mind, with nary a concern expressed by most U.S. mainstream commentators. Amazing. With that in mind, let's think about sanctions. Let's talk about sanctions imposed against you by the federal government. This is a piece that I don't believe has been released at MRC TV yet. It's about the upcoming Joe Biden Xi Jinping meeting, which doesn't have a date yet. They don't have a set date. It's a blind date. It's going to be a lot of fun. So let's get into it. Pop media are buzzing about the undated but upcoming meeting between Joe Biden and Chinese President Xi Jinping this month, telegraphing to American and Chinese citizens a number of important off-hidden points about economics and freedom, foremost among which is the dark reality that a meeting of two human beings can affect billions of people who, in a moral world, ought to be free of such tyrannical influence. Preceded by strange antagonistic signals from the Bidenistas and even former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi about the official U.S. positions on Taiwan, Hong Kong, the expansion of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization into the Pacific, and even odd tales of spy balloons, the most fundamental and perennial issue facing Biden, Xi, and virtually every U.S. and Chinese head of state for decades has been and still is the matter of the trade barriers known as tariffs. Just the term trade barrier ought to tell anyone resistance to normalcy bias that there's a problem. Trade is voluntary. It's agreed to by all parties involved. By definition, it is an exchange. And also by definition, barriers to trade infringe on freedom. They represent threats by some people against other people who want to be left alone. As a result, anyone who would like to treat his or her neighbor fairly and in peace should oppose barriers to trade, be they barriers imposed by a schoolyard bully on kids trading baseball cards or barriers imposed by government bullies over other things, including products and services. Sadly, many American politicians attempt to entice the populace into embracing this immoral trade barrier idea by telling the people that tariffs will, quote, help, end quote, the native national economy. But of course, even on that practical level, the exact opposite is true. Biden has, in essence, continued a series of destructive Trump tariffs/import taxes that the Donald wrapped in the cloak of America First in early 2018. And under that sad, improper banner, U.S. consumers have paid a lot more in import taxes to the U.S. government, preventing them from saving and reinvesting and preventing new opportunities for new U.S. jobs to start. After 16 years of a good leaving alone, the Trump administration in 2017 resurrected Section 201 of the 1974 Trade Act to, quote, investigate the too low prices of foreign-made dishwashers, washing machines, and solar cells. Then, after expression that artificial concern, and promoting said concern to special constituencies in Ohio, South Carolina, and Tennessee, where the bulk of U.S.-made dishwashers and washing machines are manufactured, lo and behold, American consumers, yep, they saw this. They might want the freedom to buy less expensive washing machines and solar cells so that they could have money left over and invest or spend all that money on other things. Well, they weren't part of the calculus. They never are when politicians cater to special interests. Thus, the U.S. in January of 2018 imposed a massive tariff of between 30 and 50% on the above-mentioned products, a trade barrier that added to consumer burdens and soon was recognized as economic poison. Regardless, the White House in March of that year imposed a 25% tariff on imported steel and a 10% tariff on imported aluminum from every nation except Mexico and Canada. And cumulatively, federal import taxes on Chinese goods soon rose to cost U.S. consumers $50 billion a year, eventually bleeding $123 billion out of consumer pockets by the time Biden took over. Ah, Mr. Trump, so great. Of course, it was not as if Mr. Trump and Mr. Biden were not warned. When Trump first pushed the added costs onto us, Senator Ben Sasse, Republican of Nebraska, observed, quote, "We're on the verge of a painful and stupid trade war, and that's bad. This isn't just bad for farmers and ranchers in Nebraska who need to buy a new tractor. It's also bad for the moms and dads who will lose their manufacturing jobs because fewer people can buy a more expensive product," end quote. Years of federal vampirism followed, and much to the chagrin of many economists, consumers, and U.S. manufacturers who actually rely on Chinese goods to make their own products and who have to pass along a certain percentage of their government-imposed expenses to us, the Biden administration didn't remove the tariffs. The policy has been a disaster. As Stuart Anderson noted for Forbes in May of 2021, quote, "The Congressional Budget Office has calculated the Trump tariffs cost the average U.S. household more than $1,200 a year. Since Biden has continued the tariffs, at some point they will be called the Biden tariffs, and the cost to U.S. households will be similar," end quote. Anderson even observed that some well-known left-leaning politicians were sounding the alarm. Quote, "On trade, Biden has voluntarily extended key Trump protectionist policies, including tariffs on metal imports, and an effort to undermine the World Trade Organization's appellate process," writes Zach Beauchamp of Vox. "He even added to some of them, signing an executive order tightening Buy American rules for the federal government and imposing tax incentives for ordinary Americans to purchase American-made electric cars." That's Trump. And 2 weeks later, end quote. And 2 weeks later, Anderson cited just-released research from Mary Amidi, an economist at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, Sang-Hoon Kong, and David Weinstein, economists at Columbia University, that offered a picture of the economic acid those tariffs have become. And they offered another general long-term lesson about the idea of tariffs, citing, among many quotes, this from Weinstein. Quote, "The tariffs protect the least efficient firms and reduce their incentives to innovate while hurting the most successful U.S. firms, reducing their ability to innovate." Sorry, I'm reading terribly here. End quote. So again, the tariffs protected the least efficient firms and reduced their incentives to innovate while hurting the most successful U.S. firms, reducing their ability to innovate. End quote. Now, as Biden and Xi prepare to meet, American consumers can wonder whether any of the tariff pressure on their wallets will be reduced, and they can remember key points when it comes to tariffs. First, politicians usually impose tariffs to give artificial benefits to politically favored special interests at the expense of competitors and consumers. Again, you know, since it's just my voice, I want to stress this. Politicians usually impose tariffs to give artificial benefits to politically favored special interests at the expense of competitors and consumers. In economics classes, we apply the term rent seeking to that behavior. It's always the situation when those politically connected forces get policy favors at the expense of captive consumers. Second, this kind of favoritism does not help consumers in the aggregate. As James Bovard observed in his groundbreaking book, The Fair Trade Fraud, protectionist tariffs generally harm the aggregated consumer pocketbook 8 times as much as they help, in quotes, the special interests being protected against foreign competition. That's a lot of money, and it could be used to help new, vibrant businesses grow rather than seeing the government get taxes and stodgy, uncompetitive, politically favored industries get business they normally would not receive. Third, tariffs often are preceded by rhetoric about so-called trade deficits. But economists know that inherent in the term trade is what belies the popular misconception of the so-called deficit. Because when people trade, there is no deficit. They exchange voluntarily, giving up what they have for something they want more. They benefit relative to their earlier state. That's why they engage in the exchange. Not only is there never a deficit in a normative trade, on the international front, when those individual trades are aggregated, there never is a deficit. Hey, everybody, we're going to be taking a quick break here from some of our fine sponsors. And when we come back, we're going to touch upon that idea of international trade and blow apart the myths about the so-called trade deficit. There's a lot more. Liberty Conspiracy on Free Talk Live.
Do the letters IRS give you anxiety? I'm Dan Pilla. I've defended people from the IRS for more than 40 years. My book, How to Get Tax Amnesty, created the tax resolution industry and is responsible for helping hundreds of thousands of people. It can help you, too. If you're a non-filer or facing IRS enforcement right now, your case is unique. You need real help, not cookie-cutter advice. My clients get my personal attention. Buy my book at danpilla.com and get a free consultation directly with me. That's danpilla.com. Let's start solving your tax problem right now.
Silver has always been nature's very own antibiotic, and only one system allows you to generate an endless supply of natural silver solutions, SilverLungs.com. You'll find no wild claims or pseudoscience, just a lifetime of nano-sized pure silver solutions. The Silver Lungs Generator allows you to make your own, so stop paying for silver solutions. The unique lung delivery system targets respiratory infections where other silver solutions simply cannot reach. See the Silver Lungs Generator and Lung Delivery System at SilverLungs.com. That's SilverLungs.com.
USA News Update. In a recent interview with Univision, former President Trump commented on the ongoing Israel-Hamas conflict, expressing the view that the situation will need to unfold naturally.
So you have a war that's going on, and you're probably going to have to let this play out. You're probably going to have to let it play out because a lot of people are dying.
Trump highlighted the challenge posed by the longstanding hatred between Israelis and Palestinians. President Biden maintains his innocence amid the ongoing impeachment inquiry led by the House Oversight Committee. Committee Chair James Comer has issued subpoenas for two former business associates of Hunter Biden and two other individuals connected to the president's son. The possibility of another U.S. government shutdown looms as Congress is required to pass funding legislation by November 17th. Newly elected House Speaker Mike Johnson has not yet outlined his strategy for a short-term spending plan to prevent a shutdown. John Schaefer, USA News.
Hi, I'm Dr. Joel Wallach, the Dead Doctors Don't Lie guy. There's no reason why you shouldn't live to be at least 100 and have a great time getting there. And I'm going to give you a free copy of my lecture that tells you exactly how to do it. In fact, after you've lived a long and healthy life, there should be only two documents in your medical chart, a birth certificate and a death certificate. I'm Dr. Wallach with a warning. If you have a 4-inch medical chart, if you take prescription drugs for high cholesterol, high blood pressure, arthritis, joint pains, and other health issues, the medical profession is failing you. They're using you for an ATM machine. My free lecture is going to reveal what pharmaceutical companies don't want you to know. There's been groundbreaking research and discoveries on how to effectively treat or eliminate over 900 different diseases naturally. It's all in my free lecture called Deadly Recipe. So call toll-free 1-855-79-YOUNG. Again, that's toll-free 1-855-79-YOUNG. 1-855-79-YOUNG.
I am a non-attorney spokesperson representing a team of lawyers who help people that have been injured or wronged. If you've been involved in a serious car, truck, or motorcycle accident or injured at work, you have rights and you may be entitled to money for your suffering. Don't accept an offer you get from an insurance company until you talk to a lawyer. And we represent some of the best personal injury lawyers you can find. Tough lawyers that will fight to win your case. And they're so good they stake their reputation on it by only getting paid if you win. So if you've been in a serious car, truck, or motorcycle accident or hurt on the job, find out today for free what kind of compensation you may be entitled to. Call the legal helpline right now.
800-524-3810. 800-524-3810. 800-524-3810. That's 800-524-3810.
Appreciate what we do? Help us advertise, market, and promote for just $5 a month at amp.freetalklive.com.
Free Talk Live. We return with Liberty Conspiracy on Free Talk Live. I'm Gardner Goldsmith, and thanks for listening. We continue now with our conversation about how politicians try to use fear of a so-called trade deficit to gain more political control. In fact, trade means there never is a deficit. Now we look at the international front. Tariffs often are preceded by rhetoric about so-called trade deficits. But economists know that inherent in the term trade is what belies the popular misconception of the so-called deficit. Because when people trade, there is no deficit. They exchange voluntarily, giving up what they have for something they want more. They benefit relative to their earlier state. That's why they engage in the exchange. Not only is there never a deficit in a normative trade on the international front, when those individual trades are aggregated, there never is a deficit. As Herbert Stein noted on page 511 in the Fortune Encyclopedia of Economics, edited by David Henderson, the term trade deficit also is a misnomer on an international level. The term we use to look more completely, we in economics use to look more completely at international exchange, is balance of payments. And as the term implies, the payments always maintain balance. Essentially, reporters who claim there was an X level trade deficit for a period of time focus solely on goods and services known as the current account. This so-called imbalance usually occurs when one national currency is strong compared to others. Thus, seeing this then sees native consumers, including manufacturers, who need foreign products to make their products, taking advantage of that strong buying power and, of course, buying lots of foreign stuff. It's one of the reasons Americans take advantage of foreign vacations when the dollar is relatively strong compared to that foreign currency in the nation where they might be traveling. They can get more for their money if they go at that time. The current account is what we typically are told is in deficit because those foreign nations aren't buying as much American-made stuff and services. Of course not. Their money isn't worth as much. You can't buy as much. But there's the other half of the balance of trade, the half that pop media and politicians usually overlook. That is the capital account. The capital account is the term applied to financial instruments, i.e. liquidity. U.S. dollars spent on foreign goods don't morph into foreign currency. They remain U.S. dollars. And if the U.S. economy is going strong, if productivity is high, that strong U.S. dollar has a lot of productive leverage on which to move. As a result, those dollars that U.S. consumers spend on foreign goods are used by the foreign recipients to invest in U.S. ventures. Here, they are offered back to U.S. businesses and startups as investment capital. In fact, as Stein notes, quote, because the current account and the capital account add up to the total account, which is necessarily balanced, a deficit in the current account is always accompanied by an equal surplus in the capital account and vice versa. End quote. Most national level politicians know this, but they insist on playing populist hero even as they harm the populace with their government imposed tariffs. Such tariffs are immoral and backwards. They tend to inspire reciprocal tariffs from foreign nations, and they should be relegated to the proverbial dustbin of history. The question remains, as Biden and Xi prepare to meet, will they change their disastrous policies and let us be relatively freer people, thus helping the U.S. and Chinese economies in the process? That should probably be out tomorrow at MRC TV. And I hope you find it worthwhile. I thought it was a fairly important piece. Let's check in with Rockfin Chat. And, of course, I know some people say, well, they're dumping. That just means that stuff's getting sold at a low price. You know, that's just rhetoric. It's just mindless rhetoric. It doesn't mean anything. Well, they're using slave labor. They're using prison labor. Well, then don't buy it. Find out. That inspires the market to actually show whether it's something is coming from China and get it from someplace else. It's up to you. It's not up to the government to tell your neighbor that he or she can't buy something. That's not the government's place. And even if that stuff could be confirmed as coming from slave labor, you're enslaving someone else domestically to pay for the police force that would block someone from buying the product of that slave labor. So you yourself are engaging in slave labor by employing the power of the state to enslave somebody to pay for the police to block that product or to punish someone for buying something that was made with slave labor elsewhere or whatever, right? There is no moral argument for the existence of the polis. It is impossible to morally argue for it. It's just not possible. Because the state requires aggression. And aggression is immoral. Not defensive violence. Aggression. Rockfin Chat, let's see what's happening, everybody. Going to close up with a big story that I want to make sure I cover for you, and it has to do with your gun rights. So let's get rocking and rolling with You Know That Theme. We're going to hit it as I'm on the screen. Go for it, one and all, with the wonderful strains of Mission of Burma coming to us from Boss Town. You might have seen this on my MRC TV page. SCOTUS showdown, 18 states back NRA speech gun case against New York. Okay, now this is a pretty big deal. This has a lot of nuances, and some of that I did not get to mention in this piece for MRC TV. It's been excised, but it's very important. The Supreme Court, November 3rd, placed onto its docket the case of National Rifle Association v. Vulo. And David Knight talked about this today. I wrote this on Sunday, but it only came out, I think it was today, November 7th. So it was a slow-moving challenge to action taken by a New York State bureaucrat that, according to the NRA, infringed on the group's ability to speak and engage in financial activity in New York. According to NRA filings, in 2018, then-New York Department of Financial Services Superintendent Maria Vulo intimidated financial institutions to distance themselves from the NRA, even as the government claimed that its messages to those financial institutions were part of its so-called regulatory role. So it's sending out certain messages. What are those messages? They seem kind of intimidating to the NRA. What's it all about, Alfie? Here's some more, my friends. Whether that's a claim to be able to regulate people's interest in supporting the right to keep and bear arms or regulate the financial institutions makes no moral difference. So let's just go back again. They said Maria Vulo claimed that her Department of New York's Financial Services, the superintendent of it, Maria Vulo, said that it was part of their regulatory role. Regulating what? Regulating financial institutions or regulating keeping and bear arms? They don't have any right to do so, and they don't have any right to do so. Interestingly enough, no constitutional power, that's prohibited, and the financial institutions, one, they have no moral right to so-called regulate. And, of course, if they interfere in already existing contract, then the federal contract clause comes into play, and that would be blocked as well. Anytime a state comes in and tells people with prior existing contracts that the state is going to put on new stipulations about how that contract can be fulfilled, that is a breach of the contract clause of the U.S. Constitution. Therefore, the majority of things like minimum wage laws on state levels, regulations on state levels, licensing on state levels, all those types of things, if they interfere with people who already have made agreements, they'd be unconstitutional if people actually paid attention to the U.S. Constitution, but they don't. So, we write here, when viewed outside that fundamental moral sphere, even when viewed outside that sphere, in the day-to-day practical realm of claimed powers under the state and federal constitution, and what is not allowed by the U.S. and New York constitutions, the New York State claim to be able to so-called regulate financial institutions and then issue so-called messages to those institutions about organizations that are legally operating, but which the state doesn't like, well, that looks a lot like intimidation. As Jack Davis reports for Western Journal, quote, in the court papers, the NRA said Vulo, Maria Vulo of the state of New York, warned regulated institutions that doing business with Second Amendment advocacy groups posed reputational risk of concern to the Department of Financial Services of New York. The NRA also said Vulo would not punish banks and insurers for past infractions if they distanced themselves from the NRA while touting penalties against those who did not dump the NRA in their financial transactions. Things like loans, things like, you know, getting checks out to their employees, that sort of stuff. I said, this sounds kind of like a mafia. The result, according to the NRA court filing, was that, quote, numerous financial institutions perceived Vulo's actions as threatening and therefore ceased business arrangements with the NRA or refused new ones. Curiously, in September of 2022, the Second Federal Circuit Court of Appeals sided with New York's Vulo, thus forcing the NRA to appeal to the Supreme Court. With the move, 18 state attorneys general have filed a brief in support of the NRA. Davis of Western Journal notes that in the brief, the attorneys general write, quote, the Second Circuit's decision gives government officials license to financially cripple their political opponents, to otherwise stifle their protected speech, whether those rivals advocate for school choice, abortion rights, religious, so-called abortion rights, religious liberty, environmental protections, or any other politically salient issue. End quote. That comes from those 18 states AGs who all signed on to that. And that was a brief to try to get this up to the Supreme Court. They supported it going to the Supreme Court, those 18 AGs. And I wrote, being able to do that is a major problem. But it always is a problem with any form of so-called government regulator claiming power over peaceful civilian activity. And this ties into our tariffs. Because the same sort of thing, folks, I just want to mention this again, and I know I brought it up before, the same sort of thing that Madeleine Albright found was no problem in putting up economic blockades against those innocent women and children in Iraq for all that time is being done to varying degrees against you through tariffs and regulations and licensing. They're doing similar things. They're blocking you from getting the services that you could get from that person. He doesn't have a license. Getting services from that person and that person's business because they're located in Canada. They're located in Mexico. You've got to raise the price. They're hurting all of us. They're doing it on the similar moral level. It's just to a greater degree and backed up by government warships off the coast in the Gulf. By government bases in Iraq, let's say now. Whatever it might be that they want to block around Iran with all those U.S. bases. And, of course, imposing their embargo on Iran, their embargo on Russia, taking the valuable things from the so-called Russian oligarchs as they impose so-called sanctions on them. They're all acts of aggression. They are in a state of war against you. John Locke would have described it as such. But that is the way the state always is. The state always is in a perpetual state of war against you, threatened aggression, and if you step out of line, you'll see what happens. You must conform, or the war becomes manifest. And in many cases, it is manifest because people don't resist. When the government says you got to get licensed, they block the competition. The people who are being blocked, if they try to resist, maybe they get arrested. Other people won't try. They'll stay low. Maybe it goes into black market. Maybe it doesn't. But these are all forms of aggression. Tariffs, licensing, regulations, new impositions, all these sorts of things. And now we go back to New York and these threats. I think they've got a pretty valid argument here. Now, it might prove that the evidence of the case doesn't prove the NRA argument, but I can definitely see this as something that the government of New York would do, especially at the time that this is alleged to have occurred under Andrew Cuomo. I think Hochul will do the same sort of thing. I said, in theory, the U.S. Constitution and the New York State Constitution are supposed to limit the kinds of activity in which all forms of government can engage. But generation upon generation have suffered at the hands of government officials who don't pay attention to those so-called barriers. It's curious that less than half of the attorneys general for the 50 states have joined in support of the NRA. Davis reports that those participating to help the gun association get heard by the Supreme Court to bring this case to the Supreme Court, they're AGs from Montana, Alabama, Arkansas, Georgia, Iowa, Kansas, Kentucky, Louisiana, Missouri, New Hampshire, North Dakota, Ohio, Oklahoma, South Carolina, South Dakota, Utah, West Virginia, and Wyoming. So you can keep those in mind if you're in any of those states, everybody, okay? If you heard one, that's yours. Good on you for that, at least. But I said, but what of the others? Can they not see that the state intimidation stifle speech shoe could be on the other foot someday? Can they not see that hypothetically one of their preferred left-leaning groups might someday see a more right-leaning government in their state capital, one which could pull what appears to have been done by Bulo in New York while Andrew Cuomo was governor? Perhaps they don't care. Because for many political operatives, the principle is not important. The various constitutions are not important. What is important is power, getting it, keeping it, and expanding it. Which means that many of them probably like the idea that if they can get into power, they can intimidate their opponents through threats of increased regulation and hand favors to those businesses that comply. Just like a New York mob tale, this seems to be about kissing the ring. Of course, as J.R.R. Tolkien warned in his Lord of the Rings trilogy, the ring of power is corruptive and ought to be shunned and destroyed. The National Rifle Association v. Volo case is expected to be heard early next year. Meanwhile, this New York government will continue to shower tax cash on lawyers as they massage the legal problem they appear to have created in their zeal to virtue signal on weapons. And by the way, that would be the state of New York, which hosts numerous weapons contractors and which will continue to benefit financially from having those weapons makers located there. Sure is nice to see how consistent the New York government is in its opposition to the spread of arms. And if you hit the hyperlinks, you'll see the list, defense contractor by state. You can go to New York, just go down here, and it is unbelievable the amount of money that they make per annum from defense contractors. Check it out. Look at this. Dollar amount of defense contracts awarded to contractors in this state from 2000 to 2020, $130,530,994,967. New York. That's how much the government of New York hates arms. But of course, they don't want people to speak out about it. They don't want people to spread the message about their hypocrisy. Let's close things off with this breaking story, which we will discuss in more detail tomorrow. Thanks to Michael Schellenberger and Alex Gutentag, Alex being a woman. FBI and DHS directors mislead Congress about censorship. Over the last year, mainstream news reporters have dismissed every new revelation of government censorship. Federal Bureau of Investigation officials who primed social media executives to censor the Hunter Biden laptop were simply on guard for Russian disinformation, they said. White House officials who demanded that Facebook censor accurate information about Cowabunga 19 so-called vaccine side effects were simply trying to save lives, journalists argued. And the sweeping effort by the Department of Homeland Security, DHS, to demand alongside academic institutes social media censorship of COVID and election information was a, quote, public-private partnership to counter misinformation, many reporters insisted. But many independent journalists disagree. We and others have documented how these efforts blatantly violate the First Amendment to the United States Constitution, which explicitly prohibits the government from abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. The FBI had Hunter Biden's laptop in its possession since 2019, but primed social media executives in the summer of 2020 to view it instead as Russian disinformation, resulting in its censorship. White House officials also demanded that social media companies censor accurate information about the side effects of the COVID so-called vaccine. Facebook complied, fearing retaliation from the White House, even though executives knew that doing so would increase, not decrease, so-called vaccine hesitancy. Emails obtained through discovery in the Missouri v. Biden case revealed how officials from the federal government threatened, berated, and pressured social media companies. In light of this evidence, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals partially upheld an injunction in the Missouri v. Biden case, ruling that some government agencies had coerced platforms into censoring protected speech. And the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals viewed the sweeping public-private effort, otherwise known as fascism, overseen by DHS's Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, CISA, to censor favored views on vaccines and elections, well, they viewed it to be in violation of the First Amendment. The court demanded that CISA, along with the FBI, CDC, and the White House, refrain from coercing or significantly encouraging social media companies to censor users. After this sequence of events, many rightly wondered how the heads of the various government agencies within the censorship industrial complex would respond to public questioning by members of Congress. After months of anticipation, this finally occurred this week when Senator Rand Paul interrogated DHS Secretary Terry Alejandro Mayorkas and FBI Director Christopher Wray. Senator Ted Cruz similarly grilled National Science Foundation Director Dr. Seth Ruman Panchanathan earlier this month on that agency's distribution of millions of dollars to promote the, quote, science of countering social media myths and disinformation, as well as the development of digital tools to track and censor so-called misinformation. The way they get away with this stuff. With the censorship industrial complex increasingly under scrutiny, America's leading thought police turned evasive, misleading Congress about their involvement in censorship. Why are they no longer defending the actions they once said were necessary for safety, public health, and national security? There's more. Facing difficult questions, America's thought police are now trying to deny their well-documented role in censorship. After Senator Paul asked if DHS had held meetings with social media companies to discuss content moderation, Mayorkas answered, quote, "We, along with other federal agencies, have met with social media companies in a public-private partnership to speak of the threats to the homeland so that those companies are alert to them." We're going to more. Of course, that's a paid piece, but I can now turn to this from Jim Jordan. Bombshell report on the censorship industrial complex. Thanks for being a conspirator for freedom. There's more to come of Liberty Conspiracy on Free Talk Live.
This is an urgent warning. America is heading for another major financial disaster at an alarming rate. We could see stock prices fall as much as 50%, but this time the crash could be more violent and come faster than you ever imagined. We are Advantage Gold, America's most trusted precious metals company, and we are here to sound the alarm that winter is coming for investors. And now is the time to take actions that may help protect and secure your portfolio with physical precious metals. Want to help protect your hard-earned money before it's too late? Call Advantage Gold at 800-900-8000 and request our free gold and silver survival kit today. Mention that you heard us on the radio and learn how you could get up to $1,000 in free silver coins. The number is 800-900-8000. Call now to get your free survival kit and see if you qualify for $1,000 in free silver today.
Advantage Gold is not an investment advisor or a tax advisor. Check with your financial advisor before investing.
Call 800-900-8000.
Did you receive a call or message that mentioned Social Security and demanded immediate action? Did the caller know your Social Security number or other personal information and tell you that your Social Security number had been used in connection with the crime? Did you feel worried that your Social Security number might be suspended, your bank account might be frozen or seized, or you could be arrested? That is not the Social Security Administration. Social Security will not threaten you, demand your personal information or instant payment, email or text you pictures or documents, or use a real government official's name to gain your trust. Social Security does not accept payments by gift card, prepaid debit card, internet currency, or by mailing cash. Criminals use these forms of payment because they are hard to trace. Do not be fooled. Hang up. Ignore them. Report this criminal activity to the Social Security Administration Office of the Inspector General at oig.ssa.gov.